This fine vessel, equipped, has cost the expedition £14,000. The Aurora, the ship which will take out the Ross Sea party, has been bought from Dr. Mawson. She is similar in all respects to the Terra Nova of Captain Scott's last expedition. She had extensive alterations made by the government authorities in Australia to fit her for Dr. Mawson's expedition, and is now at Hobart, Tasmania, where the Ross Sea party will join her in October next. I started the preparations in the middle of 1913, but no public announcement was made until January 13, 1914. For the last 6 months of 1913, I was engaged in the necessary preliminaries, solid mule work, showing nothing particular to interest the public, but essential for an expedition that had to have a ship on each side of the continent, with a land journey of 1,800 miles to be made, the first 900 miles to be across an absolutely unknown landmass. On January 1, 1914, having received a promised financial support sufficient to warrant the announcement of the expedition, I made it public. The first result of this was a flood of applications from all classes of the community to join the adventure. I received nearly 5,000 applications, and out of these were picked 56 men. In March, to my great disappointment and anxiety, the promised financial help did not materialize, and I was now faced with the fact that I had contracted for a ship and stores and had engaged the staff, and I was not in possession of funds to meet these liabilities. I immediately set about appealing for help and met with generous response from all sides. I cannot here give the names of all who supported my application, but whilst taking this opportunity of thanking everyone for their support, which came from parts as far apart as the interior of China, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia, I must particularly refer to the munificent donation of £24,000 from the late Sir James Caird, and to one of £10,000 from the British government. I must also thank Mr. Dudley Docker, who enabled me to complete the purchase of the Endurance, and Miss Elizabeth Dawson Lambton, who since 1901 has always been a firm friend to Antarctic exploration, and who again on this occasion assisted largely. The Royal Geographical Society made a grant of £1,000. And last, but by no means least, I take this opportunity of tendering my grateful thanks to Dame Janet Stancombe Wills, whose generosity enabled me to equip the Endurance efficiently, especially as regards boats, which boats were the means of our ultimate safety, and who not only at the inception of the expedition gave financial help, but also continued it through the dark days when we were overdue and funds were required to meet the need of the dependents of the expedition. The only return and privilege an explorer has in the way of acknowledgement for the help accorded him is to record on the discovered lands the names of those to whom the expedition owes its being. Owing to the exigencies of the war, the publication of this book has been long delayed, and the detailed maps must come with the scientific monographs. I have the honour to place on the new land the names of the above and other generous donors to the expedition. The 200 miles of new coastline I have called Caird Coast. Also, as a more personal note, I named the three ships' boats in which we ultimately escaped from the grip of the ice after the three principal donors to the expedition, the James Caird, the Stancombe Wills, and the Dudley Docker. The two last named are still on the desolate sandy spit of Elephant Island, where, under their shelter, 22 of my comrades eked out a bare existence for 4.5 months. The James Caird is now in Liverpool, having been brought home from South Georgia after her adventurous voyage across the subantarctic ocean. Most of the public schools of England and Scotland helped the expedition to purchase the dog teams, and I named a dog after each school that helped. But apart from these particular donations, I again thank the many people who assisted us. So the equipment and organization went on. I purchased the Aurora from Sir Douglas Mawson and arranged for Mackintosh to go to Australia and take charge of her, there sending sledges, equipment, and most of the stores from this side, but depending somewhat on the sympathy and help of Australia and New Zealand for coal and certain other necessities, knowing that previously these two countries had always generously supported the exploration of what one might call their hinterland. Towards the end of July, all was ready, when suddenly the war clouds darkened over Europe. It had been arranged for the Endurance to proceed to Cowes, to be inspected by His Majesty on the Monday of Cowes Week. But on Friday I received a message to say that the King would not be able to go to Cowes, My readers will remember how suddenly came the menace of war. Naturally, both my comrades and I were greatly exercised as to the probable outcome of the danger threatening the peace of the world. We sailed from London on Friday, August 1st, 1914, and anchored off Southend all Saturday. On Sunday afternoon, I took the ship off Margate, growing hourly more anxious as the ever-increasing rumours spread. And on Monday morning I went ashore and read in the morning paper the order for general mobilisation. I immediately went on board and mustered all hands and told them that I proposed to send a telegram to the Admiralty offering the ships, stores, and, if they agreed, our own services to the country in the event of war breaking out. All hands immediately agreed, and I sent off a telegram in which everything was placed at the disposal of the Admiralty. We only asked that, in the event of the declaration of war, the expedition might be considered as a single unit, so as to preserve its homogeneity. There were enough trained and experienced men amongst us to man a destroyer. Within an hour, I received a laconic wire from the Admiralty saying, "Proceed." Within 2 hours, a longer wire came from Mr. Winston Churchill, in which we were thanked for our offer, and saying that the authorities desired that the expedition, which had the full sanction and support of the scientific and geographical societies, should go on. So, according to these definite instructions, the Endurance sailed to Plymouth. On Tuesday, the King sent for me and handed me the Union Jack to carry on the expedition. That night, at midnight, war broke out. On the following Saturday, August 8th, the Endurance sailed from Plymouth, obeying the direct orders of the Admiralty. I make particular reference to this phase of the expedition, as I am aware that there was a certain amount of criticism of the expedition having left the country, and regarding this, I wish further to add that the preparation of the expedition had been proceeding for over a year, and large sums of money had been spent. We offered to give the expedition up without even consulting the donors of this money, and but few thought that the war would last through these 5 years and involve the whole world. The expedition was not going on a peaceful cruise to the South Sea Islands, but to a most dangerous, difficult, and strenuous work that has nearly always involved a certain percentage of loss of life. Finally, when the expedition did return, practically the whole of those members who had come unscathed through the dangers of the Antarctic took their places in the wider field of battle, and the percentage of casualties amongst the members of this expedition is high. The voyage out to Buenos Aires was uneventful, and on October 26th we sailed from that port for South Georgia, the most southerly outpost of the British Empire. Here, for a month, we were engaged in final preparation. The last we heard of the war was when we left Buenos Aires. Then the Russian steamroller was advancing. According to many, the war would be over within 6 months, and so we left, not without regret that we could not take our place there, but secure in the knowledge that we were taking part in a strenuous campaign for the credit of our country. Apart from private individuals and societies, I here acknowledge most gratefully the assistance rendered by the Dominion Government of New Zealand and the Commonwealth Government of Australia at the start of the Ross Sea section of the expedition. And to the people of New Zealand and the Dominion Government, I tender my most grateful thanks for their continued help, which was invaluable during the dark days before the relief of the Ross Sea Party. I tender my most grateful thanks to Mr. James Allen, Acting Premier, the late Mr. McNab, Minister of Marine, Mr. Leonard Tripp, Mr. Mabin, and Mr. Toogood, and many others who have laid me under a debt of gratitude that can never be repaid. Sir Daniel Gooch came with us as far as South Georgia. I owe him my special thanks for his help with the dogs, and we all regretted losing his cheery presence when we sailed for the South. This is also the opportunity for me to thank the Uruguayan government for their generous assistance in placing the government trawler Instituto de Pesca for the second attempt at the relief of my men on Elephant Island. Finally, it was the Chilean government that was directly responsible for the rescue of my comrades. This southern republic was unwearied in their efforts to make a successful rescue, and the gratitude of our whole party is due to them. I especially mention the sympathetic attitude of Admiral Muñoz Hurtado, head of the Chilean Navy, and Captain Luis Pardo, who commanded the Yelcho on our last and successful venture. Crossing the South Pole, Chapter 1. Into the Weddell Sea. I had decided to leave South Georgia about December 5th, and in the intervals of final preparation scanned again the plans for the voyage to winter quarters. What welcome was the Weddell Sea preparing for us?